As we enter the second week of December, sunrise will be around 8 o'clock, sunset at 5 to 4. Temperatures in the early part of the week will be at around 12 degrees Celsius. It will be rainy with fairly strong winds.
Welcome to the latest edition for December the 6th of the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sandwell. This edition due to arrive in your letterbox on the 6th of December and also on the internet and as a podcast.
Some headlines from this week's Express and Star. Wednesday's news. New robotic pharmacy centre given green light planning approval. Netherton's historic links to the Titanic. Thursday's news. Could a spot of Tai Chi be the answer to insomnia? Monthly jab helps those with severe asthma. NHS plea to patients. Friday's news. Sighting of the Dorito UFO. 158 more ambulance staff to help cope during winter. West Midland tram fines increased to £100. Saturday's news, breakfast with Santa at Black Country Care Home. Extra officers are tackling knife crime. Mew off licence approved in Bearwood despite objections. Monday's news, big issue tabards help keep vendors' dogs warm at Christmas. Greg's Christmas cards come with a gift of a sausage roll. Proposed new Lidl supermarket in Tipton. Tuesday's news, new HMO application in Smevic is turned down. Free Christmas parking at some council car parks.
All those stories and more courtesy of Express and Star Publications. And as always, about hour and a quarter in, we'll have a roundup of the audio described TV programmes and radio listings for the week ahead from Talking News Federation and also from the Federation, one or two articles that I think this time are related to Christmas, which of course is fast approaching, and we're hard at work on producing the Christmas special, which is really hard work this time round, but well, we're working on it. Here's the first day's news from the papers.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star dated the 26th November. Green light given for expansion of Growing Estates Health Centre. This story is brought to you by Christian Barnett. A move to build a state-of-the-art robotic pharmacy as part of a major upgrade to a Black Country GP surgery has been given the green light. Sandwell Council has approved plans that will see the Village Medical Centre, Crankhall Lane in Friar Park, Wensbury, extended to help prepare for the hundreds of new homes expected to be built in the town in the coming years. The two-storey extension would also house the pharmacy's robotic dispensary, described as one of the first of its kind in the UK, which would sort and distribute prescriptions and medicines. Installing the robot would massively improve the capacity and efficiency of the pharmacy, the application said. The plans were amended several times since being submitted in June last year, with a final amendment made in October before the planning application was approved last week. The height of the two-storey extension was reduced after a complaint from a neighbour, and the main roof would be changed from a gable to a hipped roof. The extension would more than double the building's floor space and result in 10 more part-time jobs. The work would see the loss of 5 parking spaces, which the council asked the applicant Suk Singh to justify. Councillor Simon Hackett, who represents Friar Park, had raised concerns about the plans on behalf of Crankhall Lane neighbours affected by the ongoing parking problems. A transport statement submitted in the summer said 24 parking spaces would be required for the extended building, including 3 on-street spaces which it claimed it would accommodate. The medical centre opened in 2008 and was last extended in 2016. The application described the existing medical centre as reasonably adequate, but admits the surgery would not be able to cope with the anticipated sharp rise in housing in Friar Park. The surgery and the pharmacy sit just half a mile from the proposed 600-home urban village off Friar Park Road. Another 100 homes would have been built on the playing fields behind High Point Academy in Friar Park. A statement included with the application said that the alterations also allow the health centre to take on a walk-in day appointments to alleviate the stress of local hospitals. A key feature of this development in the improvement and modernisation of the pharmacy, including a new integrated dispensing robot. The robot is one of the first of its kind in the UK and will massively improve the capacity and efficiency of the pharmacy. Historic town boasts Titanic link, friendly people and natural beauty. This story is brought to you by James Vikmorovich. It's a town which has a lot to offer visitors looking for history, community and nature, which has potential to grow. Netherton is set near the Sandwell-Dudley border. The town can feel like one you just passed through heading out to Dudley towards Old Hill or Cradley Heath or onto the Southern Bypass. Whilst the road does flow with traffic in both directions, the town is something of a hidden gem, full of history and friendly people and sitting advantageously on the edge of several nature reserves and waterways. Netherton means lower farm in Old English, and for most of its history it was a small village centred around the point where a brook crossed the Baptist End Road near the boundary of the Penset Chase and partially wooded common. It was mentioned in legal records back in the early 15th century and built up over time, being given a charter by King Giles II to hold an annual market fair, and was incorporated into the Borough of Dudley in 1865. Netherton expanded rapidly in the industrial age, and the thick seams of coal underlying the region was extensively mined, whilst blast furnaces were constructed for iron making, and the area became home to many industries including chain, anchor mail, brick making, as well as enamelling and the construction of boilers. The Netherton anchor, which was part of the Titanic when it set sail in 1912, was crafted here, and a replica has now been given pride of place in the centre of the town with Hingsley on the side. This pays tribute to its creator, Noah Hingsley and Sons Limited, Netherton Ironworks. Residents and visitors have also been able to enjoy the greenery and the wildlife of its two nature reserves. With the 247-acre Salt Wells Local Nature Reserve in the south, heading towards Briley Hill, whilst Bumble Hole is in the east of the town. Hosting canal festivals and even being the setting for filming for the upcoming Peaky Blinders movie. Within the town itself, there are historic buildings such as the Old Swan, better known as Mar Paddo's, and has been in the town since the 1860s. Amongst the people who have come to the town to work has been Bev Gregory, who runs a business at Northfield Road Primary School and has spoke warmly about the community feeling of the town. She said that there's a big community spirit here, and that a lot of the ladies I work with are from the local area and know each other, and they know the history of the place, and they're very proud to live here. I think this is what brings people into Netherton. It's the fact that we've got the canal close by, so there's lots of places where children can go and play, do nature reserve things, and Bumble Hole is quite popular with the local community. Last year we had Peaky Blinders filming on the canals as well, so that was a very big thing for everyone to be proud of, and they went down there to see it. Another person happy to live and work here is Donna Young, who runs a salon in her own name, and said that the Netherton girl, born and bred, that she was very proud to be from the town. She said it was a lovely place to work and everyone is so lovely, plus I also live in Netherton and that I don't think it's changed all that much over the years. It's got a proper community spirit and people will knock on the windows and wave at you, and so it's a great place and one with lots of hidden secrets. Whilst Donna and Bev were happy to talk about the community spirit, one person who said the town could do more and be better was Jen Hodian. She was born in the town and now lives in Stourbridge but works at Allen's of Netherton's. She said Netherton used to be really good, but I think at the moment there's too many similar businesses such as takeaways and hairdressers. I think more money is needed to be put in for a variety of businesses to come. More individual businesses are coming, which is great, but the rent is too high and some of the properties and a few of them are empty, which means that footfall is down. And whilst it's a great community, we're suffering because of the current climate. There are elements of the town which are lovely, but it needs some additional money injecting into it. Second batch of whiskey will put wonderful region on map. This story is brought to you by James Fomorovich. The history and cultural significance of Rowley Regis is at the heart of the newest batch of whisky created by a Black Country distillery. West Midlands Distillery has released the second batch of whisky in its distillery on the waterfront in Maryhill, following the successful launch of its inaugural release whisky, which sold out in July when released. West Midlands Distillery have become famous for the quality and strength of its Dr. Emer's Gin and a range of other spirits, and have added the whisky side to its extensive selection. The second release is described as a wonderfully lightly peated expression and has been created as a gateway into peated whisky, and something the distillery said it would hope to engage people on both sides of the peated, unpeated whisky fence. It is named as Rowiella after the Anglo-Saxon word for Rowley Regis, the main distillery home, and celebrates the stone, coal and smoke that made the region famous. Owner Jordan Lund said he was very proud to be able to launch the second batch and spoke about how the whisky side of the business had built up. He said that after the first batch sold out in less than 24 hours, we were stunned with the feedback, so being able to release our anticipated second batch of whisky is really special. The first release was dedicated to our family and our late mother, and this release is dedicated to our hometown of Rowley Regis, so it really feels special knowing that these bottles will find themselves all over the world, helping to put our wonderful region on the map. The release being lightly peated is very different to our first batch, which was unpeated, as we wanted to show our diversity as a distillery, still maintaining our rich, bold and fruit spirit, but opening the door to a peated expression. It is still bottled in our signature hand-painted bottle and our logo Dudley Castle embossed the glass, and housed in our custom fan box with the map of the Black Country in Birmingham printed inside, added the proud distillery owner. There will be 412 bottles of the Rowiella single malt whisky on sale from the West Midlands distillery shop with an ARV of 51.6% and a retail price of £79.95. Burglar left mum and daughter terrified during home invasion. Court told that defendant suffered from delusions and apologised to his victims. This story is brought to you by Adam Smith. A burglar has been jailed after chasing a girl around her Smethwick home, then lathering himself up in lotion, terrifying the daughter and her mother, who locked themselves in a bathroom frantically calling 999. Rimmel George, 38, of no fixed abode in Sandwell, was jailed for 2 years and 1 month at Wolverhampton Crown Court for his disturbing home invasion, which he terrified a mother and daughter. At 7 a.m. on April the 3rd this year, George punched a front door and smashed a lantern at a house in Bainbridge Road, Smethwick, and then walked to Crown Street a few minutes away. He climbed over a back fence and broke in through the back door as a 15-year-old girl was letting her dog out. George chased the girl through the house and her screams alerted her mother, who locked the pair in the bathroom calling 999. Whilst cowering in the bathroom, they could hear George setting fire to items in various rooms, shouting and rummaging through their belongings, the court heard. He ripped a radiator off a wall, undressed and covered himself in lotion, set items on fire and tore up the girl's school books before police entered the property. Officers had to pepper spray to stop him attacking. George pleaded guilty to burglary and damage to property after being deemed mentally fit to be prosecuted. Prosecutor Matthew Wyatt told the court the defendant chased the girl from downstairs through the house. Her screams alerted her mother, who locked herself and her daughter in the upstairs bathroom and phoned the police. In a victim impact statement, the mother described how the home invasion had left mental scars which still have yet to heal. She said, "This was our safe space. The emotional damage seeing my daughter being hunted like prey in our own house is hard to describe. We're both scared in our own home. She now sleeps in my room as she's also too scared to be on her own. I cannot leave the house for that long or she will imagine noises and phone the police. I was unable to accept a job offer due to still being mentally affected by the break-in. We cannot afford to fix the ripped off radiator. We had to replace the carpet where he bled whilst being arrested. He ripped up my daughter's school books and notes, which added another emotional layer to this crime. She is in a constant state of alert and suffering from PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. In mitigation, the court heard George suffered from mental health problems and stopped taking his antipsychotic drugs at the time of the break-in. He was suffering from delusions and depression. He apologised to his victims. George, who appeared in court via video link from HMP Birmingham, where he's being held on remand, has 15 previous convictions for 27 offences, including burglary and violence. Recorder Joanne Barker, KC, told George his victims remained distraught because of his behaviour. George was jailed for 2 years and 1 month. Victorian Church with Hull set to go under hammer for £295,000. This story is brought to you by Fionnuala Book. A former Methodist church dating back more than 140 years on a large site in the Black Country is set to appear in Bondwolf's next auction. The former Hallam Street Methodist Church in West Brom will have a guide price of £295,000 plus in a live-streamed auction on Wednesday the 10th of December. Colin Totney, Land and Development Surveyor at Bondwolf, explained that the Victorian property is on a site of 0.25 acres which may have potential for alternative uses subject to planning permission. Mr. Totney said that we have a freehold premise which includes a former church and various accommodation including a church hall. The property understood to originally date from circa 1883 with various later additions is located on the corner of Harlem Street and Lewisham Street with about a mile north of West Bromwich town centre. The estimated gross internal area is around 4,633 square feet, including the entrance lobby church with upper floor store and corridors to a vestry, toilets, two kitchens, two meeting rooms and a church hall, plus a basement boiler room and a small external store. The area surrounding the property is mainly residential with the Sandor Health Campus immediately opposite on Lewisham Street. Mr. Totney added that the offers in excess of the guide price may be considered ahead of the auction, with viewings to be available at 12:30 to 12:45 on Thursday the 27th of November, 1 to 1:15 on Tuesday the 2nd of December, and 12:30 to 12:45 on Thursday the 4th of December, and 1 to 1:15 on Tuesday the 9th of December. The former church will be amongst 175 lots, appearing in Bondwolf's next auction starting at 8:30 a.m. on Wednesday the 10th of December. The auction will be live streamed via Bondwolf's website with remote bidding by proxy, telephone or internet. For more details and to register to bid, people can visit https://www.bondwolf.com/auctions/properties/. Email auctions at bondwolf.com or call 0121 312 1212 or 01902 928 510.
This is Alison reading a selection of articles from the Express and Star dated Thursday, the 27th of November. Could a spot of Tai Chi be the answer to all those sleepless nights? People with chronic insomnia could benefit from the martial art of Tai Chi as an alternative to talking therapies, a study has suggested. Researchers said their study supports the use of Tai Chi as an alternative approach for the long-term management of chronic insomnia in middle-aged and older adults. In England, current NHS guidelines offer GPs to treat people with insomnia through managing issues such as anxiety, short-term courses of sleeping pills and cognitive behavioural talking therapy, CBT, for more severe cases. In the new study, 200 people aged 50 and older with chronic insomnia were split into two groups to either undertake Tai Chi or have CBT. All of the people in the study were free of other chronic conditions that may affect sleep, were not taking part in regular aerobic or mind-body exercise and had not received previous CBT treatment. They either did Tai Chi or CBT for 1 hour sessions twice a week for a total of 24 sessions. After the 3 month period was up, the CBT group had better scores on improvements to their insomnia than those undertaking Tai Chi. But 15 months after the start of the study, Tai Chi seemed to match CBT and even slightly outperformed it. Monthly jab helps those suffering severe asthma. A monthly injection could help people with severe asthma come off daily steroid tablets entirely without any impact on symptoms, a trial has found. Tezepelumab, also known as Tezspire and made by AstraZeneca, works by binding to and blocking a protein that drives airway inflammation. It was given the go-ahead for NHS use by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, in 2023. The injection is recommended as an additional maintenance treatment for patients over 12 when the usual medications have not worked well enough. Severe asthma can be treated with steroid tablets. However, taking steroids for long periods can have side effects such as mood changes, stomach problems or weight gain, as well as issues that develop over time such as steroid-induced diabetes or osteoporosis. A new trial, known as Wayfinder and led by King's College London, included almost 300 people with severe uncontrolled asthma on a maintenance dose of between 5 mg and 40 mg of steroid tablets a day. The trial found treatment with tezepelumab helped 90% of patients reduce their daily steroid use. More than half who had the injection were able to stop daily steroids altogether after 12 months. Meanwhile, two-thirds of patients stopped having asthma attacks, which was observed as early as 2 weeks into the trial and lasted for the duration of the year-long study. Professor David Jackson, respiratory medicine expert at King's College London, said, "The Wayfinder study is an important step forward for patients with the most severe form of asthma, who require daily oral steroids in order to achieve reasonable disease control." NHS plea to patients during winter. Medics are urging people across the West Midlands to use a service to help alleviate the pressure of one of the busiest times of the year. NHS Birmingham, Solihull and the Black Country said take-up of the NHS app in the area is lower than national average despite the benefits it can bring. Bosses said the app can prove to be a fast, convenient alternative to calling or visiting your GP practice. Figures show, among those registered with a GP practice and aged 13 or over, only 57% of people in the Black Country and 59% in Birmingham and Solihull have downloaded the app, in comparison with 71% nationally. Features of the app include ordering repeat prescriptions to your chosen pharmacy, booking and managing appointments, viewing GP health records, managing COVID vaccinations, and getting access to NHS 111. Dr. Mona Sidhu, local GP and medical director, Black Country ICB, said, "The NHS app is a simple and secure way for people to take control of their health, all at the click of a button. This winter, when NHS services are often busier, the app can save you time and help you get the care you need faster. From ordering repeat prescriptions and viewing test results, to checking symptoms and finding reliable advice. If you haven't already, I'd really encourage anyone with a smartphone or tablet to download the app today. It's free, secure, and designed to make managing your health easier. For those without a smartphone or tablet, the same services can be accessed using your NHS login on a computer or laptop at www.nhs.uk/NHS-app. The violence and their desire to keep attacking was vicious. Five people have been convicted after a man tragically died just days after he was brutally assaulted in West Bromwich. Father of two, Matthew Adams, from the Yew Tree Estate, fought like a Trojan as men tried to knock him out inside and outside the Gough Arms pub on Jowett's Lane at 1 a.m. on Sunday, March the 19th, 2023. An argument inside the pub led to a barroom brawl. Matthew was punched and kicked to his head and body multiple times before the violence carried on outside. He was knocked unconscious for almost 3 minutes. CCTV footage showed Matthew biting legs, landing blows whilst taking repeated kicks and punches as he refused to go down without a fight. Mark Shorthouse, aged 54, Ryan Stanley, aged 31, John Wise, aged 43, and a teenage boy, all of Sandwell, drunkenly missed their target before converging on him in the car park and left him on the floor unconscious. He died 4 days later. However, Wise spoke to him 10 minutes later when he returned to the pub to retrieve his phone. He said during the trial, "I told him he deserved a medal for not going down." However, Matthew's health deteriorated over the following days. He phoned his GP, who he told he'd been beaten up, but did not follow the doctor's advice to visit the Stonecross Medical or go to accident and emergency. He complained of more pain to friends and family on the Tuesday and Wednesday, and was found unresponsive lying face down in his bedroom on Thursday, March the 21st. He was rushed to hospital, where he died on March the 23rd after suffering a cardiac arrest. After speaking to witnesses and reviewing CCTV footage, all five were arrested in relation to Matthew's death and were consequently charged. Detective Inspector Joe Davenport from the Homicide Unit at West Midlands Police said, "Wise, Shorthouse, Stanley and the teenager subjected Matthew to a brutal attack where he was punched, kicked and dragged on the floor. Matthew was left helpless. The violence and their desire to attack, despite Matthew's clear injuries, was vicious. Nicola Stanley repeatedly hit Matthew and others in the pub, adding to the out-of-control disorder. This was a complex investigation which relied heavily on linking the attack to Matthew's death." He added, "Our thoughts remain with Matthew's family, and we thank them for their support through the investigation and the court process." Wise from Sandwell, Shorthouse of Church Vale, West Bromwich, Ryan Stanley of Peel Street, West Bromwich, and a 17-year-old boy who cannot be named for legal reasons were yesterday convicted of murder. Nicola Stanley, aged 40, from Sandwell, was found guilty of violent disorder. In tribute to Matthew following the verdict, his heartbroken family said in a statement, "Our whole family and Matt's friends continue to struggle with the loss of Matt. We cannot believe we are living this absolute nightmare. No words will ever be enough to fully describe the massive void since we lost Matt. Matt's children have lost a devoted daddy. Matt was a loving son, an adored younger brother, a kind and generous uncle, a much-loved cousin and a loyal friend to many. Matt's smile and cheeky laugh could cheer up the darkest of days, and his sense of humour will always be remembered by us all. Our lives will never be the same. We will continue to remember all those amazing memories we had with Matt, and we will cherish them forever. He was the life and soul of our family, and our hearts will be forever broken. Our family have seen and heard the horrific violence Matt was subjected to, and we are appalled by it, and utterly devastated that Matt lost his life as a result of it, with little or no remorse shown from those involved," they said. The five defendants are set to be sentenced on January the 30th.
This is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 28th of November. Sighting of mysterious Dudley Dorito. A mysterious triangular UFO dubbed the Dudley Dorito has reappeared in the region's skies after going almost 2 years without being seen. A resident in Briley Hill has shared images of a mysterious object flying in the sky near Merryhill Shopping Centre, suggesting it has some resemblance to the Dudley Dorito sightings reported in the area over the last 20 years. Posted in the Black Country Paranormal Facebook group, the pictures taken by James appear to show a flying object with flashing lights above Thorns Road, Briley Hill, on Friday, November 21st at 7:17 p.m. The post reads, "Thinking that he was seeing a formation of Starlink satellites, he pulled over in a cul-de-sac just before Stevens Park to get a better look. The craft was a huge black rectangle with lights on each of the corners. After observing this craft for a short while, it silently flew towards the Merryhill Shopping Centre and out of his view. While this sighting was occurring, James checked on Flight Scanner to see if there was any air traffic in the vicinity that could explain what was witnessing. However, there was none. James's sighting has some resemblance to the Dudley Dorito sightings that have been reported in the area over the last 20 years. Starting in 2007, This craft has been observed all over the Black Country. 158 more ambulance staff to help cope during winter. Written by Deborah Hardiman, Chief Reporter. West Midlands Ambulance Service has taken on more than 158 extra staff in a bid to better cope with perfect storm winter pressures. The Foundation Trust Operation Director Nathan Hudson said the service was in a strong position to deal with the expected challenges after setting in motion planning for the winter as far as 12 months ago. There will be 158 additional workers, some of whom will be student paramedics. The move comes as NHS bosses reveal that the influenza season has arrived around 5 weeks earlier than usual, resulting in severe illness affecting mainly older adults, and with school pupils and young adults also becoming unwell. Mr. Hudson said, "We have increased our staffing ahead of winter so that we have more ambulances to get to patients. After successful recruitment campaigning, we have several hundred more student paramedics who will be on the road over the Christmas and New Year period. There will be 158 more staff to cope with what the winter will be bringing. We are in a strong place and well prepared to deal with whatever the winter will throw at us. The planning started last year," he added. The new workers include extra clinical support staff in its control rooms, who deal with 22% of the incoming calls by directing patients to primary care services rather than sending out an ambulance. In addition, the service is rolling out a number of 4x4 ambulances across the region to help cope with snowy conditions. Mr. Hudson said the Trust was working closely with hospital acute teams and the region's integrated healthcare boards during what he described as a very difficult time of year. A previous recruitment drive resulted in hundreds of trainee paramedics joining the service. Residents are being urged to get the flu jabs as the NHS sees a combination of flu, COVID-19, RSV and other contagious winter illnesses such as norovirus, creating a perfect storm, which will in turn affect accident and emergency waiting times and ambulance handover times. Regional Chief Nursing Officer Sally Roberts said, "The winter of 2025/26 brings with it some very real potential challenges for our urgent and emergency care services. Across the system, we are already seeing continued high demand for services and increasing pressure from respiratory illnesses." Alongside this article is an image of three ambulances. Two are heading into a building of what seems to be a hospital, and one is heading out and facing towards the camera. The ambulances are bright yellow with green checkered squares on the side and red triangular stripes on the back. All over them is written ambulance. It's captioned, "More ambulance staff have been taken on." Two teenagers locked up for total of 18 years over machete attack. Written by Daniel Walton. A gang of five teenagers have been sentenced after a teen and a young man were stabbed in a machete attack in West Bromwich. It comes following an incident on November 17th, 2024, where one teenager was threatened with a zombie knife whilst he was sitting in a vehicle on Huntington Road, West Bromwich. In the incident, the victim was forced to get out of his car and hand over his wallet before the offenders drove off with his vehicle. The victim then went to meet his friends, who were sitting in another car on Lindsay Road. However, the offenders had followed him and rammed and hit the car with machetes. A boy aged 17 and a 21-year-old man sustained stab wounds and were taken to the hospital. Both suffered life-changing injuries as a result of the attack. The offenders proceeded to flee in the stolen vehicle. However, AMPR cameras spotted them on Bullows Road and the occupants were arrested following a foot chase with officers. Odin Borthwick Melia, aged 19, of Clifton Avenue, Walsall, was charged with wounding and, following a hearing in October, was sentenced to 12 years in custody. A 17-year-old boy was also sentenced to 6 years in October after being charged with wounding, possession of a bladed article, affray and aggravated vehicle taking. Last week, three 17-year-olds who were charged with affray and aggravated vehicle taking were given 12 months youth referral orders. Detective Constable Chelsea Norris of West Midlands Police, who led the investigation, said, "This incident had a profound effect upon the victims and their families. The victims suffered life-changing injuries as a result of this brutal attack. I would like to thank them for coming forward to us and for their unwavering support throughout the investigation. Carrying a knife is never the right thing to do. Every time you do, you run the risk of arrest or being involved in a serious crime which can have serious consequences, as shown in this case. It can ruin your life and the lives of countless others who may be affected by your actions." West Midlands Metro fines increased to £100, written by Daniel Walton. Penalty fares for travelling on the West Midlands Metro without a valid ticket are set to rise from £10 to £100. Starting in the new year, Metro users will need to purchase a ticket before they use the Metro, instead of buying a ticket from the conductors on board, as part of a new buy before you board policy. West Midlands Metro have said that the inclusion of the system will bring the West Midlands Metro in line with similar transport systems across the country. The move for a more up-to-date system also spells an increase in fines for those without valid tickets, with the Metro operator saying that penalty fares will increase from the current £10 to £100. Michael Redding Skilton, Metro's head of commercial, said, "Whilst fare evasion on the Metro is no higher than on other tramways, the vast majority of our customers feel it is unfair that some people think they can get away with travelling without a ticket. We share their frustration, and the increase in the penalty fare will act as a further deterrent to this unacceptable behaviour as we move towards a new, more convenient ticketing system that promotes fairness and aligns the Metro with wider industry standards." New validator poles have been installed at tram stops across the network. They will be switched on in the new year, allowing customers to tap in and tap out with their bank cards, travel passes or smartphones. Mr. Redding Skilton added, "On board trams and at stops, our new customer team will be equipped with the latest technology to check passengers have a valid ticket. Although the changes will not come into effect for a few months, we want to give customers plenty of time to familiarise themselves with the new systems."
This is Sarbjit with your news from the Express and Star. Saturday, 29 November. Chance to have breakfast with Santa at home. A Black Country care home is staging a Breakfast with Santa event on Christmas Eve. HC1's Dovedale Court Care Home in Wensbury is delighted to invite local families to the festive event from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. The home will be transformed into a cosy Christmas setting, offering the perfect opportunity for families, children and members of the community to come together and celebrate the season. Guests will enjoy a tasty breakfast alongside residents and colleagues before welcoming a very special visitor, Santa Claus himself. Every child will receive a personal gift from Santa, helping to make the morning extra magical and memorable. Tickets are priced at £5 for children and £7.50 for adults, with limited spaces available. In addition to breakfast with Santa, Dovedale Court is also hosting elf workshops on December 9, 16 and 18 from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. These enchanting workshops will invite children to step into the shoes of Santa's helpers, enjoying festive crafts, hot chocolate and the chance to make a special gift for a loved one. Children will also be able to write and post their very own letters to Santa. Places must be booked in advance at £4 per child. Extra Officers Out Tackling Knife Crime Across the Region, by James Vukmarovic. a picture of two officers on patrol in Wolverhampton. More police officers have been visible on the streets as part of an initiative to reduce knife crime and serious youth violence across the West Midlands. West Midlands Police said it had expanded its Project Guardian task force to have 5 teams rather than 4 operating across the region. The force said it had done this to build on the successes of the teams who made more than 70 arrests and seized almost 70 weapons. The impact of the task force was recently recognised by the policing minister, who highlighted the role of Project Guardian and the work of West Midlands Police in reducing knife-related crime. A spokesman for West Midlands Police said, "We will now have 50 officers dedicated to the task force, and the focus remains on preventing violence and taking weapons off the streets. There are 2 dedicated teams for the Black Country, one covering Dudley and Sandwell, and one for Walsall and Wolverhampton. This combines with the existing 2 teams in Birmingham and other for Coventry and Solihull. Officers on Project Guardian adopt a range of tactics, from plain clothed operations to high visibility patrols. They look to act on information and monitor hotspot areas. The work of the task force is having an impact. The teams recover hundreds of weapons and make hundreds of arrests every year. Recent crime figures revealed knife crime has reduced by 16% and serious youth violence has fallen by more than 13% in the region. At West Midlands Police, we're involved in enforcement and education to deter young people from carrying weapons, as we know the life-changing impact they can have. We work with partners through the Violence Reduction Partnership to divert young people away from crime. We also have officers who are in schools daily offering support to deter youngsters from violent or criminal behaviour. This is a real partnership approach and not something which policing can do alone. Everyone has a part to play. Mason calls for United Front as he hits out at scheduling. By Lewis Cox. A picture of Ryan Mason, who wants another show of force from the Baggies supporters. Ryan Mason wants Albion to unite with a siege mentality against scheduling creating an unfair advantage against his side. The Baggies head coach believes the club have been harshly treated by championship fixture organisers on at least 3 occasions this season. He spoke strongly on the issue once again in midweek in between home clashes against Birmingham on Wednesday night and Swansea on Saturday, for which the latter will have an extra 24 hours preparation. Mason has already hit out about 2 back-to-back away doubleheaders at the beginning and the end of October, where the Baggies were condemned to tough Wednesday-Saturday travel schedules. Albion's head coach has long been a big follower and admirer of the English game lower down the pyramid and knows the demands of the Championship in particular, but believes his club are being hard done to and wants everybody to rally in response. "First of all, we need everyone inside the stadium on Saturday to come and help as much as possible. Bring the same energy that was brought on Wednesday," Mason said. "I thought it was incredible. They've been incredible all season, and I'm sure they could feel a group of players that were leaving everything on the pitch. So we need to come together as a club and really try and generate that intensity Saturday. I look, and in the last 6 weeks, we went away to Norwich on a Wednesday, got home at 3 o'clock in the morning, played against Millwall away on a Saturday, who played at home on that Wednesday. In my opinion, it was a physical advantage for them. Then we had the same 2 weeks later, where we went to Watford on the Wednesday and played against an Ipswich team at home midday, who played at home on the Tuesday. So when I see this fixture come out Wednesday, I thought for sure we're going to play against opposition on Saturday, who played on the Wednesday night. But we're playing against a team that played 24 hours before us, which is strange. It doesn't really make sense to me. I'm sure the Football League can put it into an algorithm or a system that would make it a little bit more consistent. But listen, that's something that's out of our hands. I think what is in our hands is the feeling, the intensity that we can generate on Saturday. I'm so keen for us to give back to the fans because they've been great for us. Asked of raising formal complaints, Mason replied, "Listen, nothing's going to change. It's something that we need to deal with and we need to come together as a club because we understand that it's not necessarily helping us, and I don't see many other teams having to deal with that situation. We need to use it to our strength and find a way to generate something between us as a club. But it's interesting. I'm not sure why it's the case, but it's interesting." Natural spaces will thrive and survive under new strategy. By Gurdip Tandy, local democracy reporter. The picture of Mayor Richard Parker, who's standing third from the left, at the River Ray restoration project. A plan to protect and enhance green spaces and wildlife across the West Midlands has been unveiled. The West Midlands Local Nature Recovery Strategy sets out 62 actions to boost sites of nature and improve well-being and prosperity of communities and businesses. They include restoring wildlife habitats, improving the region's rivers and iconic canals, planting more trees, and opening more urban green spaces for people to enjoy. The aim is to boost biodiversity, improve quality of life, help adapt to climate change and create green jobs. The West Midlands Combined Authority, known as WMCA, has developed the strategy in partnership with local councils and environmental organisations, community groups, businesses, schools and colleges, universities, landowners, farmers and developers. West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker said, "Our region has one of the country's most distinctive landscapes, with a unique mosaic of industrial heritage, iconic rivers, vibrant urban centres, parks, rivers, nature reserves, and millions of trees. Spaces such as Sutton Park, Saltwells Nature Reserve, and Sandwell Valley are the heart and the lungs of our towns and cities. Clean, green spaces where people can connect with nature, learn and play, and do a whole range of activities that benefit health and well-being. We must treasure all of our nature assets because they have the power to drive a more prosperous, healthier, and more attractive West Midlands. This strategy will help ensure our natural spaces survive and thrive for generations to come." The mayor launched the strategy during a visit to a restoration project on a section of the River Ray on the edge of Birmingham city centre. Birmingham and Black Country Wildlife Trust is working with the Environment Agency to re-naturalise the river. This will help prevent flooding and boost wildlife, with the longer term aim of bringing the native brown trout fish back to the river. New off-licence gets go-ahead despite concerns. A decision to open another late-night off-licence in the Black Country has been approved. Sandwell Council's Licensing Committee approved a plan for the new Continental Market shop in Bearwood Road Bearwood Smethwick to sell alcohol. The hearing was held following a number of complaints from neighbours who said another new late-night shop was turning Bearwood's High Street into a health and safety risk. A decision was due to be made in September, but the meeting was adjourned over a discrepancy with the shop's layout, and the licensing committee granted applicant Ali Ashorbig's request to push back a decision so he could provide the council with the correct documents. The application was approved at a hearing on November 25. One objector said smashed glass bottles, drug paraphernalia and human waste were making Bearwood Road a health and safety risk. The High Street has more than its fair share of establishments selling alcoholic beverages and food, the objection said. We do not require any more. The shop opened in the former Twisty Pretzel Bakery, next door to another off-licence, JM Shop, which opened last year.
Hello, this is Jenny. The following articles are from the Express and Star newspaper, Monday the 1st of December. Mayor proud of school's role in new Let's Move fitness programme. A Black Country school is one of the first in the country to take part in a new government fitness programme for youngsters. Sports Minister Stephanie Peacock, West Midlands Mayor Richard Parker and West Bromwich MP Sarah Coombs joined families and school children at Riders Green School in West Bromwich as they took part in the new Let's Move campaign. It has been designed to get families in areas of high inactivity into sport and physical activity this winter. They were put through their paces as part of a local boxer size class provided by Healthy Sandwell, experiencing firsthand how the campaign is helping families discover fun, accessible ways to stay active together. The campaign is being piloted in Samwell, Lancashire, Essex and Bradford, areas with higher inactivity levels and greater inequalities, to ensure support reaches those who need it the most. According to 2023-24 Active Life Survey data, 48.5% of Samwell's adult population are considered to be physically active, over 150 minutes of activity per week, and 37.6% considered inactive. The campaign is backed by high-profile supporters, including Joe Wicks, the body coach, Olympic gymnasts Max Whitlock, MBE, and Beth Tweddle, MBE, and TV personalities Alex and Olivia Bowen. And already more than £400 million has been committed to build grassroots facilities in the places that need them the most. Mayor of the West Midlands, Richard Parker, said, "Getting children moving is one of the simplest ways to give them a healthier and happier start to life. In Sandwell, we're seeing the impact that inactivity has on families, and we also see the difference that the right support can make. I'm proud that our region is helping to lead this work. If we want every child to have the same chance to thrive, then we must break down the barriers that stop too many from taking part. Let's Move is a great example of that in action, and I want to see more of it across the West Midlands." Sarah Coombs, MP for West Bromwich, said, "It's fantastic to see the Let's Move campaign in action here at Riders Green School. Families in West Bromwich deserve every opportunity to enjoy active, healthy lives. Breaking down the barriers that hold children back from sport is so important, and I'm proud to support a campaign that meets people where they are and makes activity simple, affordable and accessible for every family in our community." Collier unlikely to feature again before the new year. Albion loan midfielder Toby Collier is not likely to feature until into the new year after his latest injury setback. Collier limped off with a calf issue just after 10 minutes of Wednesday's 1-1 draw against Birmingham City at the Hawthorns, in what was just his third start for the club. The midfielder was sidelined for Saturday's dramatic 3-2 comeback victory over Swansea, whereby his replacement, Jason Malumbi, was the match-winning hero. The 21-year-old had already missed around a month with a hamstring injury between October and November, as his Baggies loan deal has struggled to get off the ground. Collier had a scan on the calf problem on Thursday, and results returned on Friday showed bad news for the Old Trafford prospect, with the issue worse this time around and a period on the sidelines until at least after Christmas. "It's not a great one, obviously, when you come off after 10 minutes," Mason admitted. "It's not great. We're disappointed. We're gutted, to be honest, because we know the impact it can have. We certainly won't see him this side of Christmas. We'll just see how he settles down going forwards. Probably a bit longer than the previous setback, which is disappointing. We'll see where we are in a couple of weeks." Big Issue tabards help keep vendors' dogs warm at Christmas. An article by Alan Jones. Dogs who stand on pitches alongside Big Issue vendors are to receive their own version of the seller's red tabard. The social enterprise has partnered with Animal Friends Insurance to kit out the canine companions with specially designed dog tabards. Big Issue said the tabards recognise the valuable contribution of dogs who endure long spells in cold and wet weather to provide companionship to their vendor owners. They have already been distributed to a trial group of vendors across the UK, including Ian Duff, who sells the Big Issue in Bath, with his dogs Trigger and Marlene. He said, "It's really important that those tabards stand out. They're in the Christmas colour as well. My customers already love them, and I've got new people coming up every day saying they're fantastic." Another recipient of a dog tabard is Bella, a Yorkshire Terrier, belonging to Martin McKenzie, who sells the Big Issue in London. Big Issue ambassador Chris Packham visited his pitch and heard how the tabards are translating to sales. Mr. McKenzie said, "A 5-minute walk can take an hour with Bella. We have to stop and say hello to so many people. These tabards mean she's getting even more attention and bringing customers my way." Packham said, "Many Big Issue vendors are social people who enjoy interaction, and with Martin, he's got the greatest asset in Bella. She's just absolutely delightful, and she's got her own fan club, as we saw." Richard Mills, chief executive at Animal Friends Insurance, said, "Animal Friends was created with a simple wish, to bring more kindness and compassion into the lives of all animals, no matter their size, species or home. Supporting positive change in animal welfare and conservation is at the heart of what we do." Russell Blackman, Managing Director of Big Issue, said, "We're grateful to Animal Friends for enabling us to create such an adorable talking point for our vendors as we arrive in December, their most important sales month of the year." The picture shows Big Issue vendor Martin McKenzie with his dog Bella and Chris Packham, and Bella is sporting a very smart red tabard. Greg's festive card range is a real banger. An article by Josie Clark. High Street Baker Greg's is launching its first range of Christmas cards, which come with a gift of a sausage roll. The range, called the Ultimate Secret Santa Surprise, includes a £3.95 card featuring a heat-activated ink which, when warmed, reveals a code to redeem a free sausage roll or vegan sausage roll. The cards come with the option to personalise some of the designs, such as by adding a loved one's face to a sausage roll. Greg said it designed the collection particularly for those who might be struggling to think of a Secret Santa gift, or for the hard-to-buy friends and family. A survey for the baker found that 43% of people feel anxious when finding out they are involved in a Secret Santa gift exchange, with nearly a third, 31%, having to take part in two or more each year. Some, 67%, say they end up panic buying for the event at the last minute. A third, 33%, said they would be happy or delighted to receive a Greg sausage roll as a gift, and 10% said it would make their Christmas day to be given one. Hannah Squirrel, Customer Services Director at Greggs, said, "We're all about bringing a smile to people's faces. And what better way to do that at Christmas than with a card that comes with a tasty treat?" Streets set to be blocked up to make room for supermarket. An article by Deborah Hardiman, Chief Reporter. The whole of a Tipton street will be blocked up to make way for a proposed new Lidl supermarket, which is expected to provide up to 40 jobs. The Department of Transport has given the green light for Meeting Street off Horsley Heath in Great Bridge in Tipton to be stopped up to enable the budget store development to take place. Under the scheme, the existing Lidl will be demolished and replaced with a bigger building after planners at Samwell Council gave it the thumbs up in September. It will be built on a neighbouring eyesore empty plot that was once home to an MOT and van sales garage. Interestingly, that was where I had my first car from. The public notice states, "The Secretary of State gives notice of an order made under Section 247 of the Act, entitled The Stopping Up of Highway, West Midlands, No. 24, Order 2025, ordering the stopping of the whole of Meeting Street at Tipton in the Metropolitan Borough of Sandwell. This is to enable development as permitted by Sandwell Council under reference DC/24/69873. The plans for the new store include a 101-space car park with electric charging points, a relocated entrance from Horsley Heath, and more trees will be planted on the site, which Lidl says will be a significant improvement on the current hard standing and wasteland. In 2018, Lidl was granted planning permission by the council to demolish the store in Great Bridge for one twice its size, but the work was never carried out. The latest application states, "Overall, it is considered that proposed larger food store development will offer significant tangible benefits to the area, including employment opportunities, new facilities for local residents and businesses, and increased consumer choice. It is considered that the economic benefits of the proposed development are significant and will assist in the economic recovery of the district following COVID-19.
Hi, this is Kate, and I'll be reading you some articles from the Express and Star, the 2nd of December. Councillor: "We wouldn't put battery hens in a place like this." A move to build a new HMO in Smethwick's High Street has been thrown out by councillors. The move to open the 11-bed house of multiple occupancy, a HMO, above Vinnie's Opticians in Smethwick High Street was rejected by Samwell Council's planning committee amid a warning that allowing the shared accommodation was turning parts of the borough into slums. Residents and local councillors said Smethwick High Street was already suffering from overflowing bins, fly tipping, rats and other vermin, and blocked drains from several takeaways along the busy route. The plans were scaled down from the initial proposals for a 20-bed HMO submitted earlier this year, and Samwell Council's planners had recommended the scheme was approved ahead of the meeting on November the 26th. The HMO plans were condemned by neighbours in Victoria Avenue, who were not only criticised the potential problems that it would cause in Smethwick High Street, but the standard of the accommodation. The residents said only a four-space car park for potentially 22 residents in the HMO would inevitably cause problems. The resident who spoke at the meeting on behalf of objectors in Victoria Avenue said, "The management of the existing flats had been non-existent," adding that the proposed accommodation, which only provided small shared spaces and no living rooms, was inadequate. Councillor Raghi Mulfilhi, who represents the Soho and Victoria ward, said there were massive issues with rodents due to the littering and overflowing bins from nearby takeaways, and Victoria Avenue had been plagued by fly tipping. Councillor Bob Piper, who represents the nearby Abbey ward, said that he was appalled and shocked the council planners had recommended approving the application ahead of the meeting. He said the influx of HMOs, many of which had been approved by government planning inspectors against the wishes of Sandwell Council, were turning the borough and high streets into slums. "We wouldn't put battery hens in a place like this," he said at the meeting on Wednesday. "There's no common space. There's nothing. The space available for storing waste is little bigger than a cupboard. It's appalling. We're turning our high streets into slums. And if you drive into places as far as Bearwood, you'll see it turning into a slum." Deputy Leader defends budget on special visit. The budget, the cost of living and the support for councillors in Sandwell were all discussed by the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party on a special visit. Lucy Powell was in Rowley Regis on Saturday to meet campaigners, local councillors and members. The Manchester Central MP was keen to talk about the autumn budget, which featured headline announcements such as cuts to energy bills, a rise in the minimum wage and extending a freeze on tax thresholds for an extra 3 years. She said the party had made some difficult choices, but had made them to help support people struggling to get by, and said the choices made had been popular with the people that she'd spoken to. She said, "I'm pleased with the budget and it's a difficult context, but as a Labour government, I think we made some really clear choices in this budget to support people with living costs and those who are struggling to get by, and asking those people with the broader shoulders through things like mansion tax or changing a tax system to make it fairer to those who earn their income from their assets and wealth. We're making these choices to support ordinary working people with their cost of living and asking those with broader shoulders to pay their fair share." Couple behind bars for sexual exploitation and modern slavery offences. A couple have been put behind bars after West Midlands police discovered over a dozen women were victims of human trafficking and modern day slavery offences. Lugia Kuku and Costella Soare, both of Smethwick, have been jailed after pleading guilty to a range of prostitution, modern-day slavery and abuse charges at Wolverhampton Crown Court. The couple were arrested in March 2023 after West Midlands Police acted on intelligence showing that women were being advertised online for the purpose of prostitution. An in-depth three-year investigation was launched into the actions of the couple, showing that women were sexually exploited and subjected to abuse and harm. Officers from the force's major crime team found that 14 women had been victims of the couple's crimes from January 2018 until March 2023. The team also discovered that one of the victims had been trafficked into the UK in 2015 before being transported to various locations across the country. As well as being subjected to a range of physical and verbal abuse, she was also introduced to drug abuse, resulting in her gaining large drug debts, being controlled financially and being forced to work up to 20 hours a day. As well as being coercively controlled, she was also refused access to medical help. One of the couple's victims was left so severely malnourished after not having enough money to buy food that her bones could be seen protruding from her skin, the court was told. The force also found that the pair were estimated to have gained at least £734,400 due to the sexual exploitation of women and men across the country. Kuku, aged 46, was charged with arranging or facilitating the travel of another person with a view to exploitation and controlling prostitution for gain. Appearing at Wolverhampton Crown Court on November the 21st, after pleading guilty, he was jailed for a total of 9 years and 7 months. Soare, aged 37, had been charged with controlling prostitution for gain and had entered a guilty plea. She was jailed for 3 years and 2 months. Leading the three-year investigation, Detective Constable Maddy Hassan from West Midlands Police Major Crime Team said, "We've worked really hard to bring these charges against both Kuku and Soare. It's been a very in-depth and thorough investigation over the course of 3 years to comb through evidence to piece together the couple's crimes and the abuse that their victims went through. We've supported and safeguarded the victims and I'm glad that both Kuku and Soare have been put behind bars for their crimes," added the detective constable. Chocolate Nutcracker Unveiled. A chocolate creation has been unveiled as part of the return of a special ballet performance. Cadbury World has produced a creation called a fruit and nut cracker, a festive figure made entirely of Cadbury's chocolate. Every detail of the festive figure unveiled at Birmingham Royal Ballet return with their production of the Nutcracker has been handcrafted by Cadbury World's chocolatiers. The doll was crafted from 25 kilograms of Cadbury's chocolate, stands at 90 centimetres tall, and the grand reveal took place at the Birmingham Hippodrome along the ensemble of Sir Peter Wright's The Nutcracker. The creation stood tall as ballerinas twirled, blending timeless tradition with the Cadbury's magic, harking back to its fruit and nut 1970s ad, which featured Tchaikovsky's famous music. And this article is supported by a photograph of the two lead ballerinas. One is male, one is female. So the lady is in a beautiful sort of light pink tutu. And then obviously the lead man is in his tights and a top. And that's supported by the Nutcracker figurine and two employees from Cadbury's. And it's on the stage. I feel we can probably begin to grieve after car crushed. Police aim to halt racing meets like the one which claimed Ben and Liberty's lives. The families of two black country teenagers knocked down and killed by a dangerous driver watched as the car involved was crushed by the police. Damien and Lynette Caulfield were among those at T.L. Harvey in Darlaston yesterday to see the heavily modified Nissan Skyline, which is driven by Dear Al Malmouri on the night their son Ben Caulfield and his friend Liberty Charis were hit, crushed into a cube. Ebony Parks and Ethan Kilburn were also left seriously injured as a result of the horrific crash. Mr and Mrs Caulfield and members of their family were able to see the car, which had had its wheels and engine removed and other decontamination work done, up close with West Midlands police officers who had been involved in the case also present. They gathered almost exactly 3 years after Al Mamouri lost control of the blue and white Nissan Skyline and ploughed into a group of pedestrians who were gathered on the pavement at the side of the A457 Olby Road in Albury at a suspected car cruising event at around 11:30 p.m. on November the 20th, 2022. Holding photos of Ben, the Caulfields watched as the car was picked up by a crane and carried over to the crusher, with the subsequent crushing of the car taking less than a few minutes to complete. The compacted vehicle will now be taken away to Preston to be disassembled. For Damien Caulfield, it was a chance for him and his family to be able to take control of the situation and begin the slow process of rebuilding their lives. He said, for the last 3 years as parents, and I'm sure Liberty's parents have felt the same, we've had no control over this. Al Mamouri made a conscious decision to take that highly powerful, highly modified car out that night, driving dangerously, losing control and taking our son's life. From that point on and over the last 3 years, we've had no control through the process, where he lied at his initial interview, then pleaded not guilty, then sent us through 17 months of horrendous feelings in the background to appealing the sentence. I don't think there was any direct value for Ben, Liberty, Ethan and Ebony throughout the process, but today we've had control. Now that we know the car can't go back on the road, it will give us a chance to draw a line under the negativity and try and rebuild our lives and remember the good things about Ben and Liberty. He said seeing the car crushed was a massive relief and he hoped that it would send a powerful message to anyone who got involved in car cruising. He said, I wasn't sure how I would feel when we were coming down here this morning, as I was anxious and apprehensive. But now I just feel relieved, and it's imperative we honour the memories of Ben and Liberty and make sure that this never happens again. People need to know that this is not a game and not an adrenaline rush, and people who get involved in car cruising and car racing are making a conscious decision to get involved. The most horrific things might not happen, but it happened to us and it could happen to anybody and could be any members of your family. Detective Sergeant Paul Hughes from the West Midlands Police Serious Crimes and Collision Investigation Unit said that while the day could never be about closure for the families, as it was something they'd always live with, the day helped them to begin a new journey. We also spoke about the journey of getting to the car, to the crusher, how it could help families and the message it would send out to people involved in car cruising. He said it's been quite a while since the night of the incident and for the investigation to go through. And we used a court deprivation order in this particular case, which is issued by the judge at court, where he'll assess whether the seizure is legal and could be done. Everything else is health and safety. Seeking the cooperation of all the companies that have supported us in achieving this today and giving us brilliant support in allowing the families to come. I think for the families, it's important for those who want to see it to be able to do so, as this is the car which led to the loss of life and they want to see that that car is destroyed. So I think seeing it crushed into a cube helps them along the way. I also hope that it can send out a message, as it shows we have a number of powers, from deprivation orders to serious seizure powers, and all our units who are targeting this type of maintenance driving, and this car wasn't a runaround. It was imported, modified and bought for one reason, and our aim is to stop it. Now, this article is supported by a photograph of teenagers Ben Caulfield and Liberty Charis, who both died in the horrific suspected car cruising incident in Albury in November 2022. They're both pictures of them side by side. Really nice pictures of them smiling. At the top of the article, there are two photographs. So one is the heavily modified Nissan Skyline, which was crushed into a small cube. And it shows you the car literally in almost like a block, having been crushed in the machine. And there's also a picture of Damien and Lynette Caulfield, Ben's parents, watching the car being crushed. And they're embracing each other, and they've both got hard hats on. Free parking offered to festive shoppers. Shoppers will be able to park for free at Samwell Council's town centre car parks on all Saturdays in December. As the high streets ready themselves for the busiest time of year, Samwell Council has announced free parking at town centre car parks across the whole weekend. Time limits on short stay car parks still apply. Sunday parking is already free in the council's town centre car parks. The free parking does not include Samwell Valley car parks, privately run car parks and on-street parking bays. The Saturdays in December are the 6th, 13th, 20th and 27th.
When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending the Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio-described TV programmes starting Saturday the 6th to Friday the 12th of December. Starting with Saturday the 6th of December. There is a double bill of the sitcom Frasier on Channel 4 at 9:35am. This is followed by six episodes of The Simpsons starting at 10:35. Today's live championship football features Derby County versus Leicester City. Kick-off is at 12:30pm on ITV1. Over on BBC Two, Sutton United meet Shrewsbury Town in the second round FA Cup match. Kick-off 5:15. Both matches are not audio described, but the commentary should give you an idea of the action. The afternoon film on ITV1 at 3:35 is the espionage adventure The World Is Not Enough, starring Pierce Brosnan as James Bond. The couples perform routines inspired by West End shows for Musicals Week in tonight's Strictly Come Dancing on BBC One at 6:50. Sandy's adventure reaches Cannes, where she visits an iconic movie hotel and finds out about the canine film award, The Palm Dog. Sandy Toksvig's Great Riviera Rail Trip is on Channel 4 at 8:05. The town comes together in the wake of a tragic loss in the drama Wild Cherry on BBC One at 9:05. Tonight's Channel 4 film at 10:05 is the murder mystery comedy Knives Out, starring Daniel Craig as Detective Benoit Blanc. The detective is summoned to the home of an author who has been found dead. As he learns about the family, one question continues to gnaw at Blanc: who actually hired him? On to Sunday, 7th of December. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. In the first episode of a new series of My Life at Christmas with Anita Rani on BBC One at 10:30, Sir Rod Stewart and his wife Penny Lancaster reveal why Christmas is special for them. The cook helps three novices create a Christmas feast in Mary Berry's Festive Feasts on BBC Two at 11:30 a.m. Over on ITV One at 11:30, plans for a wedding are in full flight on Fletcher's family farm. More FA Cup football this afternoon, Boreham Wood versus Newport County, kick off 2:30 on BBC Two. Join the staff of Warwick Castle as they prepare for their busiest time of the year. A Warwick Castle Christmas is on ITV One at 5:45 p.m. The lion pride has grown stronger than ever, and the wild dogs have dwindled. But is there one last surprise on the horizon? Find out in the nature documentary Kingdom on BBC One at 6:55 p.m. This is followed by Strictly Come Dancing, The Results on BBC One at 7:45. A new sci-fi series, a Doctor Who spin-off, starts with a double bill on BBC One at 8:30 tonight. Barclay's ordinary life is thrown into terror when an ancient species rises from the sea. Over on Channel 4 at 8:30 in Game of Wool, Britain's Best Knitter, it's time to join the remaining five knitters in the yarn barn as they make bold, eye-catching jewellery. Now for a documentary that tells the story of three astronauts who were the first crew selected to fly an Apollo mission as part of America's original quest to reach the moon in the 1960s. Apollo 1, Destination Moon, is on Channel 4 at 9:30 p.m. Tonight's film on BBC Two at 10 p.m. is the crime thriller Sicario, starring Emily Blunt as FBI agent Kate Mesa, who is sent to join an operation to take down one of the most ruthless Mexican drug gangs. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. On BBC One, Holmes Under the Hammer is at 11:30 a.m, Monday to Friday, and The Marvellous Miniature Workshop is at 2 p.m, Monday to Thursday. Winter Walks is on BBC Four at 7 p.m, Monday to Thursday. On Channel 4, there are four episodes of the US sitcom Frasier, starting at 9:10 each morning, Monday to Friday. Heartbeat is on ITV Three at around 5:45 and 6:50 p.m, Monday to Friday. Now for Monday, 8th of December. If it's Monday, it must be quiz night, starting with Mastermind at 7:30 and University Challenge at 8:30, both on BBC Two. Jamie shows us how to prepare food weeks before the big day in Jamie's Cook Ahead Christmas on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. If you are a fan of sitcom Ghosts, there's another chance to see the 2021 Christmas special on BBC One at 8:30 tonight. In tonight's Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One at 9 p.m, the semi-finals arrive as 9 celebrities face 2 demanding challenges. The fall of the Aztec civilization is examined in the 3rd episode of the documentary series Civilizations Rise and Fall on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Tonight's episode of 24 Hours in Police Custody, Family Vendetta, on Channel 4 at 9, follows Bedfordshire police around the clock as they interrogate the suspects of a complex case. Part 2 is at the same time tomorrow. Helen and her brother try to find their mother, and Brendan believes he has found an informant within the IRA. The drama Say Nothing is on Channel 4 at 10:05. In Cumbria, a body is found by a river, but it takes years of intense investigative work before a vital piece of evidence blows the case wide open. Find out more in A Murder Without Honour, True Crime Presents, on ITV1 at 10:45 p.m. On to Tuesday, the 9th of December. A powerful documentary hears from the parents of the 3 young girls killed in the Southport attack last year, and looks at the work they're doing to give their children a legacy. Our Girls, the Southport Families, is on BBC One at 8 p.m. A new 3-part series starts tonight as a top team of Christmas crafters decorate and deck the halls of Yorkshire's spectacular Castle Howard. A Very British Christmas. Castle Howard is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Just how rich is our monarchy, and where does the money come from? On the second leg of his royal tour, David Dimbleby probes what he calls this slightly indelicate question. What's the monarchy for is on BBC One at 9 p.m. The second part of 24 Hours in Police Custody, Family Vendetta, is on Channel 4 at 9. Dolores reveals her plan to travel to London and make a symbolic statement bombing against the British legal system in tonight's double bill of the drama Say Nothing, starting at 10:05 on Channel 4. Tonight's late-night film is a crime thriller based on a true story. In 1972, black cop Ron Stallworth works undercover for the Colorado Springs PD. When he discovers a Ku Klux Klan recruitment poster, he investigates, posing over the phone as a fellow white supremacist. Black Klansman is on BBC One at 11:40 p.m. Now for Wednesday, the 10th of December. Mary is joined by celebrity friends to create delicious Christmas gifts for family and loved ones. Mary Makes Christmas is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. In tonight's Celebrity MasterChef on BBC One at 8 p.m, the semi-finals continue with 7 contestants still chasing glory. In this festive special from 2021, Bob and Paul travel by steam train to the north of England, where they fish the Eden and Tyne rivers for an English salmon. Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Christmas Fishing is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. In tonight's Grand Designs House of the Year on Channel 4 at 8, the winner of the 2025 House of the Year is announced. The drama Miss Scarlet and the Duke starts a new 6-part series on the You and Drama Channel at 8 tonight. Eliza teams up with Duke to investigate a burglary at a high-end brothel. Continues tomorrow at the same time. As Calder and Tosh close in on the motive behind Edie's murder, the pool of suspects begins to narrow. The final episode of Shetland is on BBC One at 9. The 2-part documentary See No Evil on Channel 4 at 9 gives a forensic look at the biggest scandal in Church of England history, exploring the psychology of prolific abuser John Smith's sinister world through intimate testimony from his children and widow. Continues at the same time tomorrow. On to Thursday, 11th of December. In a programme from 2009, Si and Dave prepared dishes inspired by each verse of the 12 Days of Christmas. The Hairy Bikers' 12 Days of Christmas is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. For the final push, the duos take on an epic journey of over 1,000 kilometres to the finish line. After 33 days, which pair will sign the all-important book and be crowned the winners? Find out in Celebrity Race Across the World on BBC One at 8 p.m. The semi-finals draw to a close with two challenges deciding which of the six remaining cooks reach finals week. Celebrity MasterChef is on BBC One at 9. Hazel Martin concludes her investigation into the shooting of Shamsuddin Mahmood in 1994. The Man in the Mask, an Orkney murder, is on BBC Two at 9. The second part of the documentary See No Evil is on Channel 4 at 9 tonight. Amy Harrison strives to teach well at Manor Lane, but an imminent Ofsted visit turns everything chaotic. Play for Today, Special Measures, is on Channel 5 at 9. And so we come to Friday, 12th of December. Wildlife filmmaker Gordon Buchanan teams up with seven huskies to tackle a treacherous dog sledding trail in Canada's Yukon Wilderness. Snow Dogs is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. Adam Hills, Hannah Fry and guests kick off a spectacular evening of entertainment for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7:30 p.m. Mac interrupts Glenn and Daisy's wedding when an uninvited guest collapses, apparently poisoned by an order of service leaflet. Return to Paradise is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Michael revisits his 2004 journey across the world's highest mountain range. Michael Palin's Himalaya, Journey of a Lifetime, is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Gemma and Cherry clash over the leader of Sadie's Rhyme Time class in tonight's episode of Daddy Issues on BBC One at 9:35 p.m. And finally, the late night film. Michael Caine stars as a ruthless London gangster in the crime thriller Get Carter on BBC Two at 11 p.m. So that's all for this week, and I hope that you do find something that appeals to you from this week's selections.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, December 6th. And for cricket lovers, Test Match Special gives overnight coverage of the second Ashes Test between England and Australia. Well, hopefully it'll be good news for cricket lovers. It's on BBC 5 Live Sports Extra. The Final Twist is a comedy thriller with Donald Sinden. 5 o'clock, Radio 4 Extra, Saturday afternoon. Opera on 3 presents Puccini's La Bohème from the New York Met. 6 p.m, Radio 3. While Archive on 4 celebrates 70 years of From Our Own Correspondent. Radio 4, 8 p.m, Saturday night. Sunday, December 7th, and coverage of The Ashes continues on BBC 5 Live Sports Extra. There's drama, though. Grief is a Thing with Feathers by Max Porter. 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, Sunday evening. Between the Ears, A Hymn to Water, a journey along Cumbria's River Eden with composer Jacob Poley as he discovers why the sound of water has influenced his life and work. 7:15, Sunday evening, Radio 3. And as it is the second Sunday of Advent, there's a compline, a service of evening prayers from Keble College in Oxford. 10 p.m, Radio 3, Sunday night. On to programmes then that are broadcast at the same time each day throughout the week, Monday to Friday. So same time, same radio station, every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Book of the Week is Upon a White Horse by Peter Ross. 11:45 in the morning, Radio 4, Monday to Friday. Beautiful Strangeness are essays by Rebecca Stott. Again, Radio 4, 1:45, all week, Monday to Friday. Composer of the week is A Medieval Christmas. 4 o'clock, Radio 3. While Remembering Jane Austen, all week, Radio 4 Extra at 4:30 p.m. You can relax into your evenings with Zeb Soane's Classic FM, 7 o'clock, all week. While Book at Bedtime has The Small Boat continued, it's episodes 6 to 8 this week, 10:45, Radio 4, every night. On to the rest of the radio highlights then, for the individual days of the week, resuming with Monday, December 8th. Build Baby Build, Exploring UK's Housing Problems, 11 o'clock in the morning, Radio 4. Comedy drama, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen, with the brilliant French and Saunders, 2:15, Radio 4, Monday afternoon. I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, comedy panel game at 6:30 on Radio 4. Tuesday, December 9th, An Add to Playlist is a musical journey from one piece of music or song to another to another. They go through 5 in each show, 11 a.m. on Radio 4. Nagamon Chetty has news and interviews at the same time, 11 in the morning on Radio 5 Live on Tuesday. Well, Classical Live has sea-themed musical works on Radio 3 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. One person found this helpful. A comedy about actual adverts hosted by Frank Skinner. It's in the comedy slot on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. As it's a Tuesday, In Touch, the latest news for the blind and partially sighted, is on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. I'll finish a day with The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum, 9 o'clock, Radio 2. Wednesday, December 10th. And there's a drama on Radio 4 called Trust at 2:15 in the afternoon. I trust you will take our recommendation. Unite is a comedy with Mark Steele in the comedy slot on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. The Moral Maze, which always takes a really interesting angle on a moral issue, is on Radio 4 with Michael Burke at 8 o'clock on Wednesday night. And it's the third of 4 Wreath lectures that the BBC always put on at the end of the year. This week's lecture is A Conspiracy of Decency. 9 o'clock, Radio 4, Wednesday night. Alternatively, The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is on Radio 2 at 9. Thursday, December 11th, and drama Odds On, a comedy about death, grief and guilt. Radio 4, 2:15 in the afternoon. Radio 2 in Concert features Madness on Radio 2 at 7 p.m. on Thursday. While Book at Bedtime has a two-parter on Thursday night and finishes on Friday night, Heart Lamps, part 1 of 2, 10:45 on Radio 4. Friday, December 12th. And Last Word, a reflection on the lives of those who've recently died. Radio 4 at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. The Findhall Garden, listening for evidence of fairies, fauns and nature spirits in a settlement in northeast Scotland. Radio 4 for this at 4:30 on Friday afternoon. Dead Ringers has a topical take on the season of Goodwill. Radio 4, 6:30 in the comedy slot. Well, Friday night is, of course, Music Night on Radio 3 at 7:30. There's a new episode of Add to Playlist with those 5 musical connections I was talking about earlier. 7:15, Radio 4. And if you want to stay up late, or maybe go and listen to it on BBC Sounds, because it's available right now, 1 o'clock in the morning, so Saturday morning, but Friday night, Saturday morning, Dick Van Dyke, the ultimate song and dance man, is on at 1 o'clock in the morning on Radio 2. Alternatively, go and listen to it on BBC Sounds. That's it. Thank you to Angela for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
TNS Soundings. Welcome back to the Express and Star Pub Quiz. And this week's round, it's Celebrities and Entertainment. Question 1. Which Mary Poppins actor joked, "If I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself," as he nears his 100th birthday? Question 2. Which actress from Smethwick starred in the audio-described films Billy Elliot, Paddington and Harry Potter? Question 3. What has the Royal Opera House commissioned to honour the King? Question 4. What Disney Plus series based on a Jilly Cooper novel won the Best Drama Prize at the International Emmy Awards? Question 5. Alison Hammond and Jonathan Ross are to feature in a documentary on which famous British toy shop? Question 6. Who won Strictly Come Dancing in 2024? Question 7. Which British band could be the next to feature in an ABBA Voyage-style AI hologram show, according to its guitarist? Question 8. Which Oscar-winning actress is among the festive guest editors of BBC Radio 4's Today programme over Christmas? Question 9. The TARDIS arrived at which English ancient monument as part of the celebrations for Doctor Who Day? And question 10. Which West Midlands comedian earned BAFTA nominations for his hit BBC show Man Like Mobeen? How's your celebrity and entertainment knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for the celebrities and entertainment round. Question 1. Which Mary Poppins actor joked, "If I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself," as he nears his 100th birthday? Dick Van Dyke. Question 2. Which actress from Smethwick starred in the audio-described films Billy Elliot, Paddington and Harry Potter? Julie Walters. Question 3. What has the Royal Opera House commissioned to honour the King? New stage curtains. Question 4. What Disney Plus series based on a Jilly Cooper novel won the Best Drama Prize at the International Emmy Awards? Rivals. Question 5. Alison Hammond and Jonathan Ross are to feature in a documentary on which famous British toy shop? Hamleys. Question 6. Who won Strictly Come Dancing in 2024? Comedian Chris McCausland. Question 7. Which British band could be the next to feature in an ABBA Voyage-style AI hologram show, according to its guitarist? Queen. Question 8. Which Oscar-winning actress is among the festive guest editors of BBC Radio 4's Today programme over Christmas? Kate Blanchett. Question 9. The TARDIS arrived at which English ancient monument as part of the celebrations for Doctor Who Day? Stonehenge. And question 10. Which West Midlands comedian earned BAFTA nominations for his hit BBC show Man Like Mobeen? Guz Khan. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, I'm Colin. Now, we may think that we know the story of Christmas inside out, but do we? Really? It's time to unwrap the myths and true origins of Christmas. So, here we go. Before December the 25th was fully recognised as Christmas Day, it was already a significant date for another form of worship, the most widely practised religion in the Roman Empire. Its name? Mithraism, after the god Mithras, who reputedly sacrificed a sacred bull in a spring fertility ceremony. The birth of Mithras was also marked at the winter solstice, when he's said to have emerged from his birthplace in a cave, witnessed by two shepherds. More than that, we can't really say. The earliest evidence we have for a celebration of Christ's birth is when Julius I, Bishop of Rome from 337 to 352, decreed that Christ's nativity was to be observed on December the 25th. But it wasn't until the year 380 that Christianity became an established religion in Rome. Christmas, and some of the stories surrounding it, probably owes its key date to a merging of Christian and pagan traditions. According to biblical scholars' calculations, based on the Gospels and other church writings, April the 17th, May the 29th, and September the 15th are all more likely dates for the birth of Jesus. Now, interestingly, the question has often been asked, if Mary gave birth in December, why were the sheep still in the fields in the winter months, when they should have been taken into the villages for warmth? Answers on a postcard, please, but not to me. That said, the choice of December the 25th seems instead to have been tied to the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, which, when you think about it, makes more sense. The Venerable Bede, who seems to have had an opinion about everything, claimed in about 730 that ancient Britons referred to December and January as Yule, probably derived from a Norse word, jule, which originally meant festivities. Quite how he knew this is anybody's guess, but then he wasn't called Venerable for nothing, was he? It wasn't until sometime after the 9th century that the word Christmas, or rather Christ's Mass, replaced Yule in the British Isles. The use of Christmas gradually became standard, and Yule only returned in the 19th century with the rekindling of love for ancient traditions. By the 11th century, in France, a star was hung over church altars for an Epiphany play that was incorporated into the Mass. And the story of the Magi, of Herod and the massacre of the innocents, was acted out. Soon after, in the 12th century, English churches also staged these plays. Another form of theatre originated with Francis of Assisi, who, in 1223, produced a replica stable with a manger and real animals, an ox and an ass, setting the scene for the model animals which came along much later. Moving on to the 13th century and the reign of King John, courtly Christmas feasts became mind-bogglingly elaborate. On Christmas Day 1213, the king's household and guest consumed, wait for it, 27 hogshead of wine, 400 head of pork, 3,000 fowl, 15,000 herring, 10,000 eels, 100 pounds of almonds, 2 pounds of spices, and 66 pounds of pepper. Well, I bet they wished they'd had Gaviscon in those days. Thankfully, Edward III later tried to curb excess, passing laws restricting the meals on 7 of the holiday's 12 days to just 2 courses, with a limit of 2 kinds of meat per course. Very sensible. A quick jump to the 16th century now, where an historian claimed that in previous centuries every parish had a great pole serving as a maypole in summer, decorated with holly and ivy in the winter. But don't get too excited, this wasn't a Christmas tree as we know it today, but it might be considered a precursor. An association between trees and Christmas was emerging, especially in Germany, and by 1531 there was a new fashion with Strasbourg markets selling trees for people to erect indoors, although these were apparently not yet decorated. The first decorated indoor tree we know of appeared in 1605, again in Strasbourg. Adorned with paper roses, apples, wafers, gilded sweets and sugar ornaments, it was what, a few years later, would be given a new name, a Christmas tree. Just to add a downer at this point, in Scotland in 1561, the newly reformed Kirk declared all of Christmas a nasty popish invention and banned the holidays entirely. By the turn of the century in Scotland, carol singing, playing football, making music and dancing were all banned as being profane activities. Joining in the fun and not wanting to be left out, a growing number of ardent English Protestants also began to condemn the secular holiday. The English Civil War was particularly unkind to Christmas. Oliver Cromwell and his mates saw Christmas, of which there was no mention in the Bible, as a mark of the Antichrist. So, in 1643, Cromwell's Parliament sat on the 25th of December to make sure everyone understood that this was to be a working day like any other day. And by 1645 it was decreed that festival days, vulgarly called holy days, have no warrant in the word of God and are not to be continued. What a bunch of killjoys. Fortunately, the English ban didn't survive long after Cromwell's death. But apart from 1660 to 1690, the Scottish Kirk's ban continued until, and I'm not making this up, honest, 1958. Yes, 1958, when Christmas became an official holiday in Scotland for the first time in a quarter of a millennium. Towards the end of the 17th century, Christmas quickly regained its popularity, although many continue to fear that the holiday seduced the population to, and I quote, drunkenness, gluttony, and unlawful gaming, wantonness, uncleanness, lasciviousness, cursing, swearing, and ultimately idleness. The playwright William Davenant, sometimes said to have been Shakespeare's godson, had a character claim in one of his plays that more children were begot in the Christmas holidays than at any other time of the year. When the spirit of mince pies reigns in the blood. Strong stuff, eh? Not everyone felt the same. One 1675 carol booklet looked forward to Christmas. So we'll all be higgly-piggly one with another. Whatever that means. In 1767, a group of London bakers placed advertisements stating they wouldn't be giving traditional tips to their customers' servants on the grounds that if the lower ranks wallow in wealth during the holy days, they will spend it all on alcohol. That just sounds like an excuse to save money to me. To celebrate Christmas, said one newspaper, was to celebrate rioting and drunkenness. To be fair, this wasn't probably far from reality. Joseph Banks, the naturalist on Captain Cook's first voyage, recorded that the Endeavour's crew kept Christmas in the old-fashioned way. All hands were drunk as our forefathers used to be on the like occasion. The poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge visited Germany in 1798, and in 1809 wrote an essay describing the local Christmas tradition of decorating homes with boughs from trees. It was reprinted in the Times, and 14 years later, a tabletop tree appeared in an engraving of Queen Victoria and Albert, celebrating Christmas at Windsor Castle. That single image cemented the Christmas tree in the popular British consciousness, so much so that by 1861, the year of Albert's death, it was firmly believed that this German prince had transplanted the custom to England with him when he married. But it's in the works of Charles Dickens that Christmas first meets the modern world. His 1843 novel, A Christmas Carol, provided a new way of thinking about the holiday. No longer did it have to be the Christmas of Oldie England, where the squire was in his manor house and all was right with the world. Now it could be a Christmas where working people travelled home by public transport from counting houses and offices, where charity was the remit of the rising middle classes, not of the gentry taking care of their own tenants. Following Dickens' lead, Christmas pursuits such as cooking the turkey, playing games, drinking toasts, or buying toys for your children became part of the new middle-class domesticity, leaving the religious aspect partially out on a limb. Talking of limbs, the branches of Christmas trees lit by candles represented a frightening fire risk. A lit tree was never a safe tree, and many households lit their candles only once on Christmas Eve, prudently keeping to hand water and a stick with a sponge on the end. It was America that produced the first commercial string of electric lights. In 1891, a tree with lights powered by electricity was put up in the children's ward of a New York hospital. Later, a department store brochure assured customers that the lamps are all lighted at once by the turning of a switch, will burn as long as desired without attention, and can be readily extinguished. A much safer option. It was America, too, that produced the image most of us have of Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, when Coca-Cola ran an advertising campaign from 1931 to 1964, and again in the 1980s and 90s and beyond. Although his red coat first appeared in the 1830s, it was the Coke ads that spread the quintessential Santa across the globe. A white-bearded man wearing a red jacket trimmed with white fur, belted across a substantial midriff, red trousers and black boots, and, frequently, a red pointed cap with white fur trim. Rudolph, too, was a commercial invention. The red-nosed reindeer appeared in 1939, courtesy of a department store copywriter named Robert May. By the 21st century, Christmas was, and still is, being celebrated by many who shared none of its traditions, who weren't or aren't even nominally Christians. Magazines, books, film and television have transmitted the formula to places where the meaning of the symbols matter little. Christmas has assimilated traditions from half a dozen cultures and countries, and it's these contrasts and these changes that make Christmas what it is today, a holiday that shape-shifts itself to become what we, what our cultures, need it to be at any given time. Christmas has transformed itself over the centuries, from a time for the nobility to display their wealth to their dependents, for adults to enjoy what little extra they could gather, to a festival primarily for and about children. From the elite to the masses, from adult to child, from public to family. While the holiday has altered, it's survived. It's thrived. Because, ultimately, Christmas is not what it is, or even what it has been, but what we hope for. Merry Christmas.
TNS Soundings.
Express and Star report West Brom 3, Swansea 2. Brilliant second-half turnaround as Mollenby goes from villain to hero. Jason Mollenby was the headline act again as he went from villain to hero with a winner to cap a memorable 3-2 comeback victory over Swansea. Under fire, Ryan Mason's Baggies looked dead and buried 2-0 down at half-time after Swans raced into a remarkable scoreline, including an opener on 11 seconds, the second fastest championship goal on record. The boos and chants against Mason and the players were audible as the visitors roared ahead and at half-time, but Mason rang the changes with four alterations to spark the comeback. The deadly Orn Hegerbo was to thank for firing his side back into a breathtaking second half as the Norwegian struck twice in 7 minutes after the break to make it 7 for the season. But the afternoon belonged to Mollenby, who 7 days ago was hounded out by Baggies fans for his senseless red card at Coventry, but rewarded Mason for his faith with the winner 5 minutes from time. Few wanted to see the Irishman in the starting ranks after his dismissal in Coventry, but he popped up with a decisive moment late on. All four half-time changes, Carlin Grant, Josh Marger, George Campbell and Christian Bielik, played their part in a thrilling second-half turnaround which went against the narrative of strong first halves and woeful second periods under Mason. The first period and Swansea's early lead was as bad as it has got under the head coach and the fears about where it left him, and his Hawthorns tenure were very real in front of a half-empty and apathetic home crowd. The Baggies were lifeless and totally uninspiring as struggling Swans, winless in six and with four defeats, tore through them with Josh Griffiths guilty on at least one occasion. By full time, that struggle was consigned to the record books, and Mason and all involved will hope the stirring turnaround will be the start of a brighter dawn. But that is still to be answered. There were empty seats inside the Hawthorns everywhere ahead of kickoff. The atmosphere was lifeless, and a rendition of the Liquidator was half-hearted at best. Mason and his players needed the first part of the game to go their way, and it could not have been more the opposite. Officials timed it at 11 seconds as towering striker Jan Vipotnik lobbed an angled finish over the stranded Griffiths from the left corner of the box. Many spectators had barely noticed kickoff as the ball bounced over the line and the away end celebrated. An aimless Swansea ball from kickoff was needlessly headed clear by Nat Phillips from right back, on top of Alfie Gilchrist, where the former did not need to be. It left a gaping hole for Goncalo Franco to cushion a pass into Vipotnik. Griffiths tried to come out but wasn't quick enough, and the lobbed finish was easily. Time stood still in a silent Hawthorns. Boos rang, as did cries of "You're not fit to wear the shirt" and "You're getting sacked in the morning." Some home fans even made for the exit after 2 minutes. A response was not forthcoming. Albion were all at sea with confidence on the floor. Samuel Eiling Jr., in for Carlin Grant, was jeered. Isaac Price screamed with frustration as he failed to pick out Jason Mollenby, controversially back in with an immediate recall, favoured over Ousmane Diakite. The midfield was played through with the hosts crumbling. Swansea sniffed more and were rewarded. There should have been little threat when Ethan Galbraith resouved the ball 25 yards out, but the former Manchester United youngster's strike towards the top corner slithered through Griffiths' grasp. It should have been comfortable. It was another horror moment for the goalkeeper, as the Hawthorns made its feelings clear once more. Albion attacks were barely even that. Recent improvements in the final third went out the window. Passes were under or overhit from midfield and defence. Wingers had no conviction in their attacks, and Orn Hegerbo was dominated. Price and Mikey Johnston, the latter so sharp of late, hit almost apologetic efforts at the comfortable Lawrence Vigoureux, who threw his cap on them. Audible boos greeted Tom Neild's half-time whistle. For Mason, it was clearly a time to act, and he did so with four substitutes. Introduced were George Campbell and Christian Bielik for Gilchrist and Phillips respectively, and Josh Meyer and Carlin for Price and Eiling Jr. in attack. It was a big roll of the dice, and it paid off immediately as Swansea's lead was wiped out in 7 minutes. Man of the moment, Hegerbo proved the Albion sharpshooter once more. Alex Mowat found him with a pass on the edge of the box 2 minutes after the restart. Hegerbo spun his defender onto his left foot expertly and sent a crisp, low finish under Vigoureux. It was game on, and the Hawthorns responded this time, and 5 minutes later the hosts were level to a raucous backdrop. Johnston's corner from the right was won by Campbell and dropped to Hegabo, who thrashed in another left-footed finish, first time into the ground and high into the net. This time the wind was in Albion sails after the flattest of first periods, with Swansea rocking. Away boss Matos responded with two changes to steady the ship. It worked from a Swans perspective, with the Baggies unable to maintain the one-way traffic flow thereafter. The visitors camped back into a comfortable shape, content with their point, and the task to break down proved challenging. Hegabo looked the most likely again as he flashed a flicked header wide across goal and nodded at Vigoro. Johnston was the provider of ammunition, as two excellent crosses were not gambled on or attacked as they should be. Swansea tried to be stubborn, but Albion upped it as Callum Stiles drove wide from range. Johnston was on a one-man mission, and he cut onto his left, but was denied a wonderful goal by the outstretched hand of Vigoro. Hegabo looked to have spurned a glorious opening as he fired at the keeper, with Grant waiting for a tap-in. But the story was not yet written, as last week's villain had the final say, and did so with aplomb to convert from Marger's touch after a Grant cross. Mason tore down the line as Mullumby and co. charged into the technical area. Could it be the spark needed?
Hi SDN, it's Prince, and today I'm going to be reading to you the full article I wrote about the Church in the Garden. Uncovering Hidden History, The Church in the Garden, Blackheath Sandwell. The Church in the Garden, founded by Walter Darby, was not always a private chapel tucked behind an ordinary house. It was once a place for a community of believers in Sandwell to meet, which began with one man's evangelistic dream for such a community in Blackheath, his grandson Martin Pearson reveals. Journalist Prince Lyer looks at the reason for this shift. Along a path of trees and bushes decorated with bright yellow sunflowers and red berries stands an old chapel at the end of Martin Pearson's garden. Its uncracked brown painted doors might make you think that this church is fairly new, but it was once just a small shed. Now, this quiet chapel with almost a century of history is a landmark in Blackheath which few may remember. It didn't have to be a great cathedral. Originally from a non-Christian family, Walter Darby found his passion for sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ in his early 20s. He distributed leaflets of the gospel with the Homeland Missionary Society based in Liverpool. Darby worked on the leaflets in the shed during 1938, which became a small congregation including Darby and his colleagues at the Homeland Missionary Society. The Homeland Missionary Society helped my granddad distribute these leaflets. They began to attend little meetings in the shed, and so the shed became in effect a little church. It didn't have to be a great cathedral, just a place where two or three people could meet, Martin Pearson said. It was very poorly ramshackle built. The Church in the Garden was officially established in 1944. As the church became more popular in the community, spacing to accommodate the growing congregation and newly established children's group became an issue. They did their best with what they could with the materials available after the war. My granddad wasn't much of a builder. The building was quite narrow that you could almost touch the walls. It was very poorly ramshackle built, but it had heating and electric supply, Pearson said. Despite the issue, services in the church created fond memories for the early members. David Hill, son of a member of the Homeland Missionary Society and former attendee of Church in the Garden, remembers the services of the church and the personal influence of Darby's mission. I remember being fascinated with Walter Darby's printing of tracts. For a small assembly of attendees, the hearty singing was able to lead the piano playing. It was lovely to witness Walter Darby's true and faithful servant of the Lord, he said. It is highly uncommon today, but not so much in the past. Church in the Garden was the first time that I had heard of a church built on private property. I had to find out whether this had been done before. Canon Ray Corbett, Chancellor of the Archdiocese of Birmingham, said that regarding Catholic churches, it is highly uncommon for a parish church to be built on privately owned residential properties. Standard practice for today is for churches to be built on land that is publicly accessible and formally consecrated. This often follows a structure beginning with the identification of suitable land from a diocesan member and ending with a ceremonial consecration from a bishop. The ceremony dedicates the building solely to divine worship. Although rare today, privately owned churches were once more common. Historically, it was not uncommon for wealthy Catholic families to establish private chapels on their estates. This was vital in England before Catholic emancipation, when such chapels had to be discreet to avoid persecution, Corbett said. St. Charles Borromeo, also known as Hampton on the Hill Church in Warwickshire, is the Catholic church which began from a private chapel. The chapel in the house of owner Lord Darmer was officially established in 1808, which was then extended to its present form in 1830. It is a rare circumstance that churches such as this still exist today in the Midlands, Corbett said. International prominence. While examples of private chapels exist within the Catholic Church, Church in the Garden is a non-denominational church. It was not consecrated and used solely for divine worship as such. Pearson said that the Church in the Garden building was used for more than worship, specifically through its use as a meeting place for overseas charity workers. We were involved in a charity called Friends of Chernobyl Children's. For 10 years, our church was used as a meeting place for that charity, who organized aid for Belarusian children suffering from the Chernobyl disaster. What happened to Church in the Garden? It was sad to hear that Church in the Garden is no longer operating. Pearson told me that the last public service for the church was held on the final Sunday of 2019. Although this was before the pandemic, Pearson thinks that in hindsight, the restrictions of COVID would have made it difficult for the church to continue. I don't know how it would have gone on in COVID if we had tried to obey the rules. COVID has affected a lot of churches even today. A lot of churches which held two services now only hold the one on a Sunday morning, he said. But the potential difficulties of COVID didn't explain to me why there was little to no information of the church online. It was like its whole history was erased or even not kept. I knew I had to dig a bit further than the internet. After a 25-minute drive to Southeast Sandwell, I arrived at Sandwell Archives, located in Smethwick Library. The wall of photographs, black and white, fading into colour, showed the history of areas such as Cape Hill from 1960 to 2011. It was a promising first sight. I was happy to find one document preserved about the church in the garden. It was a newsprint cutting from the Worley News Telephone dating back to September 1972. As I zoomed in and sharpened the microfilm reader, the article verified some information about the international reach of Darby's mission and the church. Namely that he managed to reach 28,000 people with tracts and Bibles sent to Nigeria, Uganda and America. But where was the rest about the church and why hadn't more been preserved? Maureen Roldren, local studies and outreach officer for Sandwell Archives, said that not all information about historical places is automatically given to the archives. For newsprint cuttings particularly, it is generally only articles that people considered important that were cut out and preserved, she said. Waldron also explained how information about churches are stored in the archives. If a church is a parish register, we get records for certain parishes, for example, Worley Parish. But because Church in the Garden was a non-conformist, we don't automatically get information about them, she added. What's next? I asked Pearson about the possibility of holding public services again. As an active preacher himself, he explains that for the church to fully open would require a change in his schedule. I'm often away on a Sunday, so it would need me to plan a change in my schedule, but we never know. But we'd be ready to open at some point. The buildings and the facilities are here. He mentioned the possibility of reopening again as a small meeting place for his immediate neighbours. We look to the Lord to lead us, he added. Thank you for listening, guys.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Mary Buckley with an article written by Fiona to help you get ready for the festive season. The Royal National Institute for Blind People, the RNIB's Joy Maker's Guide to Christmas, is a treasure trove of accessible activities that the whole family can take part in. From gifts and toys, tasty treats, a trip to see a panto, tips for safe sledging, and even whoopee cushions, it's all in the guide. In the days leading up to Christmas, it's time to make sensory decorations using citrus peel and to string up homemade paper chains. Everything is explained in detail in the RNIB guide with easy-to-follow instructions. For parents, baking with your child is a great bonding opportunity as it allows you both to explore many different sensory experiences together. As well as being a tasty treat, the guide includes a recipe for gingerbread stars that can also be turned into unique tree decorations. If any Christmas snow proves too difficult to resist, there are step-by-step details on how to build your own Swedish snow lantern with snowballs and to light them brightly by placing a tea light in the middle of the structure at the base. The guide also includes tips for safe sledging, a great activity that, when managed carefully, lets children with visual impairments experience the joyous feeling of moving at speed and the adrenaline rush it brings. Finding the right accessible toy for a child with visual impairment can be a challenge, but the RNIB offers a range of ideas to help with this. One example is to search out toys which encourage a child to follow movement with their eyes, which might encourage the development of hand and eye coordination. The guide also includes suggestions for toy and gift ideas recommended by parents and by the not-for-profit organisation Toy Like Me, offering stocking fillers and low-cost gifts. All this information is available on the RNIB's website at www.rnib.org.uk, where you can search for The Joy Maker's Guide to Christmas and download the document as a PDF file. Have fun!
TNF Soundings.
Thanks to all our volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles, James, Alison, Lauren, Sarbjit, Jenny and Kate. Thank you to Sue for picking everything that everyone's read this week. Thanks to Ray for putting it all together. Sarita for uploading everything so that you can listen online or via the podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And thanks to Tony and Gavin for putting everything on the USB sticks and sending them out in the post to you. Well, have a lovely week, everyone. We're working very hard on the Christmas special at the moment, so we're very excited about all the things that we'll be bringing to you before Christmas. So bye for now. Have a good week.
Thanks to, as always, to you, Pam. And it's been a busy week for Pam and all the people who provide help and assistance at SVI, and they're going to various places, including Lichfield, and there'll be the Christmas party bash next week at Samwell Town Hall, and we hope to get some recordings to be used in the Christmas special coming up. And by the way, if you know anybody who can send us a bit of music to use as background or to break up the spoken word stories and poetry, we'd be very glad to hear from them, because we're having a bit of a job this year finding Christmas music, though I am working on it for the Christmas edition. But now we have to close. It's over to this week's In Touch about an interesting shop in the East Midlands selling products of interest to blind and visually impaired people. I'll close now, though. Get the USB sticks back to us ASAP to keep the news flowing into your letterbox. Bye-bye for now this week from me and all the team, and be back with you next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.